Two points. But first point is about the home that was lost, the memory of a lost home. My teenage sons and I sometimes talk about things that give them a feeling of nostalgia. So, for example, they used to watch Toy Story movies on repeat, you know, just like on a loop when they were little, right? You know, just as soon as you get to the end, then you hit press again, and then, you know, here we go again. Now that they're grown up a little bit more, they're still growing up, but you know, they're bigger now, and they don't watch those movies so much, but from time to time they catch it, and they watch it, and they talk about how they get that feeling, and I know what they mean. It's sort of an achy, happy, sad feeling, right? You get that when you sort of like remember a gauzy time of innocence and security and happiness that we don't have access to now because we are too grown up. I believe that this feeling of nostalgia is tied to a yearning and a longing that's been wired deep into our hearts. We have embedded in our unconscious a memory of a home that we've lost a long time ago. In Ecclesiastes, the writer of Ecclesiastes says it in this way, that God has placed eternity into human hearts. And I think a way to think about that is we possess this memory of a primordial state where we used to enjoy a life of peace with God, and we now live with a longing for it. You know, it's kind of like we're living life like we're homing pigeons, and there's this unspoken drive within us to get back home. So, in the beginning of the Bible, we find a garden where we find the first family. It's a man, a woman, and God, and they're living together. Adam and Eve, under God's parental care, start working at creation and they're about to grow and flourish and multiply and grow into all of their potential. And you know, amazingly, it says that they used to walk with God in the cool of the day. Can you imagine going for a walk in the evening with God as a part of your regular routine? Hey kids, God's coming over for dinner. And afterwards, we're going for a walk in the woods with him. It's a picture of a home that is shot through with abundance, love, contentment, and glory. And you get it whichever direction that you're looking at. It's the home that God has prepared for us to live all of our days with him. In fact, Eden is presented as a microcosm of creation itself. The whole entire world is portrayed as a home that God has prepared for humanity where they can grow and flourish and thrive and live all of our days enjoying abundant life forever with God. But the Bible continues the story, and there's a disaster. Adam and Eve disobey God and betray their relationship with him, and now they need to leave their home. The end of Genesis 3 has angels guarding the way back to the garden with flaming swords. That way is closed, it's not open. The good home that God prepared for us has now been lost to us, and the world that Adam and Eve are exiled to is a hard place, it's a cruel place, it's full of sadness and violence and sin. A brother murders his own brother. Tyrants rise up and put others under their thumbs. We hurt each other. We reject the good life under God's rule. It's a world that's breaking down, ruled by sin and death. And as we look around our world, you know, we can see that this picture rings true in multiple ways. That when we hear the terrible news of earthquakes in Turkey and Syria claiming unimaginable number of lives, when we experience fear living in a city that seems to be getting overrun by violence, when we feel righteous anger, when a society either is refusing to or is unable to make the changes that it needs to correct an injustice, we shouldn't just say, well, that's just the way it is. You know, there is something that cries out inside of us that says, that is not the way it should be. In other words, we're experiencing the world as exiles, living far away from home. But the Bible also preserves a hope of a future deliverance. Good news. That God will yet be faithful and will save his people and restore them to their home. When the Israelites are delivered from a life of slavery in Egypt, when they are out in the wilderness, God instructs them to build a tabernacle. And this is part of the Exodus where, you know, after all of the really, you know, exciting stories, and then this is when people slow down, you know, because this is like all these chapters just describing the tabernacle that they're supposed to build. What in the world is this doing here? And so, you know, this is when people peter out, you know, in their Bible reading, and then Leviticus really kills them. What's this doing here? This is a special tent in the middle of the Israelite camp that is going to move with them all of the years that they're in the wilderness, where the presence of God dwells. And if you're reading this description of the tabernacle, you realize that the tabernacle is designed to recall the Garden of Eden. There's a candle stand in the tabernacle, and that's the menorah, right? Which represents the tree of life that's in the middle of the garden. There are the cherubim over the Ark of the Covenant, which represents the angels guarding the way back to the garden. The precious stones on the garments of the priests who are assigned to do priestly duties at the tabernacle, these are the same precious stones that's found in the Garden of Eden. In other words, the tabernacle is a representation of the home that we have lost. And what's really significant about the tabernacle is that the presence of God dwells there. And you know, so the Israelites could say, even if they were wandering around out in the desert in tents, God lived among them. God has an address with them. And their representative, Moses, could enter into the tabernacle and meet face to face with God, just like Adam and Eve could with God in the Garden of Eden. See? It's a hope. It's a promise. And the story of the Bible continues, and the people enter the promised land, and the tabernacle becomes a temple, and it seems like at last they have a home, and they regained the paradise that they lost, but it was not meant to be. Just like Adam and Eve were unfaithful, the people of Israel are also unfaithful, and in the end, it culminates in judgment and in exile. The Israelites get carried off from their homes as prisoners of war to Assyria and to Babylon. The city of God is left devastated and desolate, and the temple is demolished and left in ruins, the home that God's people could have had, where they might have lived in the presence and the blessing of God, is lost all over again. Now, the exiles do return, and they do rebuild a nation, but it would not be the same. When the temple is rebuilt, there are people who cheer, but then there are people who weep, because the new temple could not be compared to the splendor of the original. And moreover, the homeland is always under the threat of various empires, besides Babylon and Persia and Assyria. In between the Testament times, there is Alexander the Great, who brings in his empire, and the Seleucid Empire rules over the Promised Land for a time. And then the Roman Empire marches through and occupies the land. And so the people are thinking, is this truly home if somebody else is in charge? So the people hold on to this long-nurtured hope for the Messiah, the Anointed One, who is going to be sent from God and will deliver the people from bondage, defeat and turn away these other kingdoms, and will establish God's rule. And so they wait for the Messiah, who would one day restore God's people to their own. See, that's the backdrop. And it's into this world that Jesus comes. And that's how you need to understand when he says, I am going to my Father's house to prepare a place for you. Right? Because what he's talking about, and people kind of get this, he's talking about the long-lost home of the people's hopes and dreams. He's talking about the garden that Adam and Eve were exiled from. He's talking about a return to the place where we walk with God in the cool of the day. He's talking about the fulfillment of all of our yearnings and longings to at long last be home and be whole. It's an astounding claim, right? And Jesus has a lot of astounding claims throughout the Gospel of John. And the disciples have a hard time understanding him. One, because his claim is that he is the one that all of this has all been leading up to. But number two, they also have a hard time because of what he says about the way to get home. And that's the second thing we're going to talk about. It's the way home. Peter has this exchange with Jesus that shows what a rough time the disciples are having making sense of Jesus. Jesus says, I'm going to go away in a little while, and where I'm going, you can't follow now, but you will later. And Peter says, why not now? I'm willing to lay my life for you if that's necessary. And this is when Jesus prophesies Peter's denial. Will you really lay down your life for me, Peter? You have no idea how unprepared you are to take the road that I'm about to take. But you're going to find out. You know, read through any of the Gospels, and you find that there's a fundamental disconnect between what the disciples are expecting of the Messiah and what Jesus understands as his mission as a Messiah. Right? The disciples, like the people around them, were waiting for a Messiah who would come conquering, defeating the enemy, restoring God's people and to their rightful place and give them the glory and establishing God's rule as a triumphant king. But Jesus confounds his disciples repeatedly at this point. Whenever he does something amazing and people are saying, this is the Messiah. We're going to make him king. we want to carry him into Jerusalem ourselves and to try to make him king by force. What does he do? Instead of riding the wave of the popular support, he goes and hides himself. A terrible political strategy. You know, when they're on their way to Jerusalem and the disciples are getting ahead of themselves and they start arguing, who's going to sit at his right hand? And who's going to sit at his left hand? Jesus says, the Son of Man must be betrayed and handed over to be tried and be killed. Talk about a downer. Come on, Jesus. What? What? And then Jesus looks at them and he says, and for you too. Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. The disciples are thinking the way to get home is the way of triumph and victory. But instead, here comes Jesus saying, the way home is the way of the cross. Jesus' way back home is the way of sacrifice for the sake of the other. The way of love for neighbor and love for God that leads to faithful obedience in spite of cost to self. The way home is Jesus saying, Father, if it's at all possible, take this cup away from me. Yet not my will, but your will be done. In a little while, Jesus says, I will take the way of the cross. That's what it takes for me to prepare a place for you in the Father's house. And remove the flaming swords guarding the way home. I need to come under the sword and clear the way for you. Once I prepare a place for you, I will return and I will take you on the way of the cross yourself so that you too can find your way back home. Now, this is precisely the kind of talk that the disciples do not want to hear. There's a reason why the disciples repeatedly don't understand Jesus. It's not necessarily because they're not the sharpest knives in the drawer. It's because they don't like what they're hearing. What they're hearing is too much. The way home that Jesus is proposing is too costly. This is not what they signed up for, right? They're willfully misunderstanding him. Later, Jesus says, "You will see me resurrected and receive the Holy Spirit, and you will understand." But right now, the disciples do not. See, the disciples are a stand-in for you and for me because they're struggling with Jesus the same way that we struggle with Jesus. We long to get back home. We yearn for the glory, and we yearn for the healing, and we yearn for the belonging. We hunger for the comfort and the security of being home at last, but all of the myriad ways that we devise to try to get there end up being dead ends. Why? Because they're not the way of Jesus. We're trying to avoid the way of Jesus at all costs and trying to make our way ourselves. The same way that Adam and Eve sought to gain wisdom and life apart from God's direction and instead ended up getting death, we seek to find our way home apart from the way of Jesus and we end up lost. And we end up wandering around far from home. Look at what Thomas says to Jesus. "We don't know where you're going, so how can we know the way?" And that's when Jesus makes this trifecta "I am" statement. And he says, "I am the way, I am the truth, I am the life." If you are going to find your way back home, okay, you need a map that will show you the truth about the lay of the land and about the roads that you're going to take. If you don't have a reliable and accurate map, you will be lost. There are a lot of maps, but there's only one that will show you how to get there. And if you're going to find your way back home, you're going to need the right kind of provisions for the journey that's going to sustain you on the way there. Because if you don't, then you will run out and you won't be able to make it back home. If you're going to find your way back home, you will need a guide who knows the way because he's already traveled the way. And he can take you through all of the ups and downs of the road, all of the dangers and the curves and the bends in the road, all of the choices of knowing what fork to take in the road, when and where. Jesus says, he is all of this. He is it. There will come a time when you will doubt and your strength will run low. But if you stick with him and you persevere in following him on the way of the cross, he will be faithful to the end. And he will make sure that you make your way back home to your resting place with the Father. Many of you right now, you have question marks, so many question marks about the future. You don't know what road that you're supposed to take, and you're crying out to the Father, "What is it that you want me to do? What choices do you want me to take? What road am I supposed to take here?" Do you hear Jesus telling you, "Do not be afraid. I am the way. I am the truth. I am the life." I wonder how we, living in America in 2023, think about this idea of home. What picture do we use to construct our ideal home? And I think about the IKEA catalog. Many of us have those rolling around somewhere in our homes, maybe several years worth. For some reason, this is how my brain works. When I think about IKEA catalog, I think about the movie Fight Club. The movie Fight Club is one of those movies that serves as a marker for my generation, Generation X. And now I'm put myself in the category squarely among you of one of the old heads, and that's okay, I'm embracing it. And in the movie, Ed Norton plays a character who's living the typical company dude life. You know, working a job he doesn't believe in. That takes him everywhere, and so he's nowhere at any particular time. He goes through his days numb, sleepwalking through life. But, you know, he can buy things. So that's what home is, according to the gospel of consumerism. It's a place where you can place the stuff that you buy to look like, say, an IKEA catalog page. And, you know, there's this one scene in the movie when the camera pans over his apartment. And as it pans over each piece of furniture, you know, there's this label that pops up over it, you know, and, you know, it's kind of like with a vague Swedish-sounding name and a price tag, just like an IKEA catalog. And a home that looks shiny on the surface, but underneath is hollow and empty. It's a portrait of paradise brought to you by consumerism. And the movie, as it keeps on unfolding, it's a sharp commentary on the modern consumer society. These disenchanted young men, adrift and lost in this consumer society, but they're yearning to belong to something, and they want to feel something. So they find each other, and they form a club that starts out with, you know, beating each other up. And then it develops into causing mischief and mayhem out in the world. And so at one point, the Brad Pitt character gives this group of people a sermon. And he's railing against the consumer system that's turned them into docile consumers and mindless worker bots. And it says, you are not your job. You're not how much money you have in the bank. You're not the car that you drive. You're not the contents of your wallet. You're not your khakis. You know, I've edited it for content. is rallying lost young men with father issues. When one of the characters is asked who they'd like to fight the most, he says, my own man. And so, you know, phrased differently, what they're saying is, we're lost. We're alienated from our home, and consumerism's not helped us to get home, and we are mad about it. But like many modern works of art, Fight Club gives a searing analysis of modern life, but fails to provide a satisfying solution. The Fight Club guys, they rejecting mindless going along with consumer society, end up just as lost, if not more. Their answer is, assert your true, wild individual self and tear down the system that's made you into a sheep. And this gives them a temporary sense of freedom, but in the end, it gets them nowhere. They're still just as cut off from home, still in exile, stuck in a dystopian ruin that they created themselves. The way of Jesus is different. It's neither mindless trust in consumerism nor in the violent rejection of it. Rather, the way of Jesus is the way of the cross, following in the footsteps of the Savior who has given himself for us. This morning, what is the way that you're on? And is the road that you're on really leading you home? It could be that you've lost your way lately, but it's not too late. Jesus has always been here with us. He's never left us. Although some days you might be feeling that he's left you. And this morning, he is inviting each one of us back to himself, who is the way, the truth, and the life, to walk the way of Jesus once again. I think it starts with a confession. Lord, I am lost without you. Lord, I've been trying to make my own way, and it's not been working. Lord, what you want of me is to trust you, that you won't lead me wrong, and to embrace the way of the cross and not try to go my own way. What the Lord wants from his church is to be a community who truly is walking the way of the cross. And that's how the world will know that the way home is real and not just some another nice-sounding idea that you can believe in for a while and discard when a new one comes along. The community on the way of Jesus serves and loves and forgives sacrificially. This is the way of the cross. This is the way. Sorry. When the church gives itself to projects that, for example, provides more decent, affordable housing accessible to low-income neighbors, you know what it's doing? It's providing a real glimpse of the ultimate home. When the church doesn't spend all of its time to trying to be as influential and privileged and as possible like every other special interest group, but instead lives to make spaces of hospitality and forgiveness and mercy to the stranger and the forgotten and the down and out, as well as to each other, it becomes a signpost to the kingdom, to the greater reality that is to come. Don't you see? That's why Paul and Peter says that we, the church, are now the temple. We are the temple of God. The followers of Jesus, when they come together to go the way of Jesus, become a home that has been prepared by God in this world, where the world can come and see God and meet with God. So this morning, church, have you lost your way? Church, do you need to find your way back? Jesus is here to lead the way, full of grace and truth. We're not lost because Jesus is with us and he is faithful. He has gone before us and he knows how to lead us on this road. Walk with him on the way of the cross and he will grant you a real taste of home in the here and now. Everything on the side of his return is going to be partial, and everything will have a tinge of sadness and disappointment. But the joy of finally being home, prepared by the love of Jesus, you can have that here and now. And it's real. You know, we might welcome home from a distance, but we can serve and love and live for the Lord with the future joy now. Although we live as exiles now, we're also home now, because why? Jesus isn't some off far away someplace in heaven away from us, but he's walking with us on the road towards home right now. There's an amazing story told in this book, The Long Walk Home, by Slavomir Ravic. It was made into a movie called The Way Back about 10 years ago. It was so amazing, in fact, that a number of people doubted that it was actually a true story. It's a story of a Polish prisoner imprisoned in the Siberian Gulag. And he escapes with a small group, and this is back in 1941. Their goal was to walk all the way from Siberia and reach the British-ruled India. So if you can kind of think about that, right? And that's how they're going to get their freedom. And they ended up walking a whole year across the Siberian tundra, the great Gobi Desert, and across Himalayas. And these are some of the most unforgiving terrain on Earth. And when it was all said and done, they covered 4,000 miles on foot. And you can see why some people thought that this couldn't be true. That walk pales in comparison to the cosmic journey that the Son took, all the way from the arms of the Father into our world in exile, even to the cross, and then to the grave. Nor does it compare to the journey the Son took out of the grave to ascend to the right hand of the Father, where he sent his Holy Spirit upon his people. Nor does it compare still to the journey that he's going to take one day to bring the city of New Jerusalem, which is the final flowering of the Garden of Eden, from heaven to earth. And on that day, it will be said, at last, the dwelling of God is with men and women. At last, we'll be home. Jesus has taken this long walk for you. You can join him and take this walk with him now as well. No matter how long it might seem sometimes, he's with you. He is the way home. He is our home. Friends, today, let's rest in him. Let's dwell with him, and let's walk with him. Let's pray. As we bow our heads before the Lord, let's commune with the Lord. And let's hear the Lord as he searches our hearts. He knows if you've been feeling lost lately. He knows what you're going through. He's already taken that way. He knows what it feels like to be rejected. He knows what it feels like to take on hardships. He knows what it feels like to not feel like he has the strength to trust. But he's taken all of this for our sake and has traveled the road that has been set so that he can prepare a place for us.